From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, people transported through time and space with Gary Stearman. Get ready for that. It's also Emerging Artist Night tonight, so you'll hear some of their great work. Here's what's happening. On October 1st, widely spaced sunspots 1302 and 1305 erupted in quick succession, revealing a very long-distance entanglement which was not obvious before. NASA Solar Dynamics Observatory recorded the double blast. Part of the eruption centered on sunspot 1305, and it sent off a coronal mass ejection right toward us. It is a very slow-moving cloud. It's expected to reach the planet on October 4th, possibly causing some geomagnetic storms when it arrives, and of course, we'll keep you on top of that. Florida officials are puzzled as to how millions of honeybees were killed in Brevard County. Several beekeepers in the county have reported lost colonies this week. Charles Smith of the Smith Family Honeybee Company says he lost 400 beehives. He says the bees appeared to have been poisoned. Police have reopened the Brooklyn Bridge after more than 700 anti-Wall Street protesters were arrested for blocking traffic lanes and attempting an unauthorized march across the span. The arrest took place when a large group of marchers participating in a second week of protests by the Occupy Wall Street movement broke off from others on the bridge's pedestrian walkway and headed across the Brooklyn-bound lanes. And police have arrested 24 protesters for trespassing during a demonstration against Bank of America's foreclosure practices at the banking offices in downtown Boston. Organizers say about 3,000 people joined the protest there. Meanwhile, smaller protests popping up now in cities all around the country. Stephen Quayle, one of our regular guests on Coast to Coast AM. A lot of unhappiness out there, Stephen. What's happening?
Well, basically, George, this is, in my opinion, the orchestrated takedown of the Western financial world, and I think it's going according to the plan. Now, never in the history of the United States have so few controlled so much of the nation's wealth at the expense of so many. And what you're seeing is what I would say is the Hegelian dialectic in place. A problem has been created. The banking cartel obviously has, in my opinion, plundered the middle class. And what you're seeing now are people starting to realize that without jobs, homes are irrelevant, and without jobs, it becomes pretty hard to feed your family. So I think that what we're seeing right now is the Illuminati's plan in full motion, almost on cue, to generate a massive, massive wave of civil disobedience throughout the country. And this is exactly what you and I spoke about. I was talking to Tom Banheiser earlier tonight, George, and I said it was either 5 or 7 years ago, and I can't remember, you know, exactly when you and I spoke, and you said, do you think we will have civil war or something to that effect? And I said, absolutely. And you said, you hope not. And I said, I prayed not, but I think we're going to have it. What's happened where we used to be a cohesive country and we were Americans first, our country of origin was secondary. Now we've got so much division, and you know, a house divided can't stand. And now what you've got is you've got Roseanne Barr. I think you probably saw this on Drudge making a statement that bankers should be beheaded.
Yeah, I saw that, Steve.
And I got to tell you something. That and what I think there's something there that's interesting, George. Number one, I think it's a poor statement, but number two, it's reported that a lot of the Wall Street bankers are sitting and pouring champagne out their windows. Now this is not proven yet, but Marie Antoinette, the Queen of France, said, let them eat cake when the peasants.
And what happened to her?
Yeah, she got her head cut off. Now, look at this. Now we've got Wall Street bankers saying, let them drink champagne. And I think the contempt, you know me, I am absolutely an advocate for getting involved in people's lives, making a difference, as you have, helping our fellow Americans, not sitting there and flaunting it in their face by, you know, pouring champagne, whether it's a Dom Perignon or whatever, out the window and rubbing people's noses in it. And I think the fact is that you've got the biggest hypocritical Congress and Senate in the history of the United States, and people claiming to be on the side of the poor, and these people are knocking down, you know, $10 million a year vacations. I won't go into details, but we've got people that are taking vacations in the White House that have never been, they've taken more than the previous 10 presidents before them.
Absolutely. Stephen, keep your eyes on this one for us. Stephen Quayle. By the way, police say a Montana woman has been arrested after security screeners found a loaded handgun in her purse at the Albany International Airport. It's not a big story, but it is Stephen Quayle's wife, and Stephen is under an order that he cannot say anything. They claim, of course, it was a big mistake, and I just wanted you to know that story because it's around the internet, and full disclosure here on Coast to Coast AM. Rescuers scrambled to deliver food and water to hundreds of villagers stuck on rooftops for days because of flooding in the northern Philippines, where back-to-back typhoons have left now at least 59 people dead. Art Bell and family find they are not there. Hurricane Ophelia has weakened as it churned toward Canada, but forecasters warn that it will still bring heavy winds as it heads toward the Avalon Peninsula. Ophelia, Category 2 storm. Winds right now 100 miles an hour. Ozone loss over the Arctic this year was so severe that for the first time, it could be called the ozone hole, like the Antarctic one. About 13 miles above the ground, 80% of the ozone lost. It's because of the real cold weather that they had there in the winter. The Paradigm Research Group, seeking formal acknowledgement of an extraterrestrial presence. They are looking for your help for disclosure. Steve Bassett heading up the campaign. Steve, you needed 5,000 signatures. We have it posted and linked at coasttocoastam.com. You're over that, but you want more, right?
Yeah, the petition went up on the 22nd of September. That's when they launched this petition process on the White House website. Any petition getting 5,000 signatures or more within 30 days will be reviewed by the White House and we'll get a formal response. We got 5,000 signatures in 4 days, currently at 6,600. The petition, George, is as simple as it could be. It reads, "We, the undersigned, strongly urge the President of the United States to formally acknowledge an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race and immediately release into the public domain all files in government agency hands and military services relevant to this phenomena." This is a golden opportunity for people to make their statement about this. It costs nothing. They publish the first name and the last initial. The link to this petition is up on your website now, but for those who are out there listening on radio, don't have access to the site, it's a simple link. It is wh.gov/G, capital K, capital C.
Simple enough.
Yes, sir?
How many signatures you want, Stephen?
Look, I'd have to catch up with the marijuana petition. I think it's sitting at 49,000. Let's see if we can catch that petition. If we can get up in those ranges, we're going to track a lot of news.
Okay. You very well might by tonight. Of course, that's the voice of actor-singer Pat Boone, and he's going to join us at the moment because how can science and faith intersect? Can it? Questions about God with Pat Boone next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. This is going to be a real tweet for you this hour. Actor, singer, author, songwriter Pat Boone. His public career in entertainment began when he emceed a teenage talent show in radio and television back in Nashville, Tennessee, a long, long time ago. And at one point, he was the second largest recording artist, right under Elvis Presley. He still is the number one guy on Billboard for consecutive weeks of being way up there, tops in the charts. And he's got a different facet of his life that we're going to talk about in a moment as well. And also, he acted in one of my favorite movies, Journey to the Center of the Earth. I love that movie, Pat.
Yeah, there was something really special about it. And, you know, I didn't want to do it. I had to be talked. I had to be induced to make that film, bribed to make it. And I mean, really, the 20th Century Fox gave me a percentage of profits after they recouped their investment, uh-huh. Which, of course, we thought because of the studio bookkeeping, which was rather notorious, probably would never happen. So, but my manager, my agents, everybody said, this is a Jules Verne film. They want to make a huge science fiction film. And I'm saying, I don't want to do that. I want to do musicals. My role model was Bing Crosby.
Sure. And you were a great singer.
Well,
and you still are.
A singer, yeah. So science fiction. But then Jerry Wall, the producer, said, look, we'll put some music in it. Well, you'll sing a couple of songs in it. I said, it's still a science fiction film. But I was just short-sighted, I must admit. So they talked me into it. They bribed me into it. We did it. I gave it everything I had with James Mason, mm-hmm. Arlene Dahl. And it was a very expensive film. It was a big gamble, too, for 20th, because this was not the day of science fiction.
That's right.
It was teen musicals, Beach Blanket Bingo.
Yeah, and that's what sold them,
yeah,
right?
And April Love, yeah, and things like that, State Fair. So anyway, I got talked into it. It was a great experience to do, and it went on to become really, literally a cult
classic. It's a classic. I think it's better than the remake that they did a few years mm-hmm. ago. I've got a copy of it. It's one of those, when I first saw it as a kid, I don't want to say that I'm younger than you, but I mean, I just couldn't get enough of it. I mean, I loved it. I loved the duck, and I loved the Norwegian guy. And,
yes.
You know, I just like the whole thing. Yeah.
Hans Belke.
Was that all done on a set?
Not all of it though. You know, the scene where we were climbing this mountain to start the descent, it was supposed to be an extinct volcano.
Yeah.
And we were climbing this mountain to begin the descent. It was supposed to be Arctic weather. It was in Needles, California. It was in Needles, and the temperature was like 120. And we had heavy woolen clothes. We were carrying packs on our backs. They had to keep mopping our faces to get the sweat off. And they had blue filters on the cameras,
right,
so that it looked very chilly and cold, and yet we were nearly dying of heat prostration. But we got that filmed, and then we went to Carlsbad Caverns, and we filmed many nights way below the surface of the earth.
It must have
way
been
down
weird
there in the cavern.
Yeah.
Yes, one night, because it was night, and I was still not used to working at night, so there came a break for me. I didn't have to do a scene or two.
Mm-hmm.
And I lay down under a rock overhang. I mean, I don't know how far below the surface of the earth we were, but we had to take a elevator way.
Well, you're right in the middle, according to the movie.
Well, we hadn't gotten it yet. Hadn't reached the center of the earth. So now I dozed off. And while I was asleep, I felt something nibbling at my ear.
Ooh.
And I started like this and bumped my head on the stone overhang over my head. It was a giant white rat, albino.
Yeah.
I mean, because the thing...
Nibbling at you.
And nothing way down there had ever been exposed to sunlight. It was way down, hundreds of feet below the surface.
And he's looking at you going, dinner.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was helping himself. A little smorgasbord.
I love it. Well, you know, your career took off. We do something here on the first Sunday that I'm on, Pat, and it's an idea that we came up with called Emerging Artists.
Oh, yeah.
We play for the first couple hours. You'll hear it on our next break. Bumper music from people who don't have an opportunity to get on the radio or to do that. We have fun with it. For you, what was that break, that one moment that changed your career?
It was the most improbable thing. It was a high school talent show in Nashville, Tennessee. Now, it's a musical town. And, you know, a lot of singers, didn't come from Nashville. Very few did. They come to Nashville, mm-hmm. and they settle in. Even Paul McCartney and people like that have gone to Nashville to record. But I was in high school. I was already dating the girl that would become my wife. I entered a East Nashville High talent contest. I had been in talent contests all over Nashville. I did it just because I could.
Did you win them all?
No. No, I didn't.
Really?
I didn't win any. I would generally come in second.
Would you win on American Idol today?
I don't think I would.
In those days?
I don't think I would get on American Idol. I think if I auditioned, no kidding, because the singers that have evolved since that time, they all have these high and extreme ranges, and they've learned singing from Mariah Carey.
Yeah, yeah.
And they sing in a way that I never did. I sang the melodies. I sang, you know, I was a love song, a balladeer.
Were you a crooner?
A crooner, yeah. Because if I was going to be anything, I wanted to be a young Bing Crosby.
Yeah.
Rock and roll came along after that break I was going to tell you about. I win this one talent contest. The first prize was a trip to New York and an audition, not a guarantee, but an audition with the Ted Mack Amateur Hour, which
That was huge. That was like American Idol.
It was like
right?
American Idol.
Yeah.
It was the forerunner. And if you appeared Ted Mack's Amateur Hour, if you were voted the winner by the viewers, cards, letters, and sometimes phone calls, then they would bring you back the next week. And if you won 3 weeks in a row, then you would qualify for a kind of a showdown with other three-time winners whenever that would happen. You never knew. It'd be a year, it could be 2 years before there would be enough three-time winners. Well, I was a three-time winner and went back home and enjoyed a lot of local celebrity, married my wife, Shirley. We moved to Denton, Texas.
How old were you?
19.
Just a kid.
Yeah.
Just a kid.
And so I'm going to be a school teacher, preacher, I think.
Uh-huh.
And this thing of winning the Ted Mack Amateur Hour 3 weeks in a row would be just a blip in my resume, something that happened, an odd thing to Professor Boone, you know, the teacher. Well, the time did come after we moved to Texas. I was in school at North Texas State. They call from New York. We've got a lot of three-time winners. We're going to have a big show, and you're one of them. So I was flown to New York. I appeared. I sang, "I Believe for Every Drop of Rain That Falls," and did well. In fact, they told me I was winning eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to stay that week until the Saturday when it would be declared who won. And while I was there, Arthur Godfrey had a talent scout show called just Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts. It was a Monday night talent show for a half hour, three singers or three performers. Well, I went over to CBS just to audition. I mean, I was in New York, nothing to
Why
do.
Not?
I didn't know anybody.
Yeah.
And I went into this cold studio, and a woman in the control room just through the speaker said, "Well, go ahead and sing something." I had no music, so I sang, "I Believe for Every Drop of Rain That Falls." I could sing that with no music. And she said, "Nice." She said, "Can you come back in 3 weeks?" I said, "Oh, no, ma'am. My wife and I, we're expecting a baby, and I'm going to have to get on back by the end of this week." She said, "Okay, we'll put you on tonight." Tonight?
Wow.
And so I had to scrounge around and find somebody to be my talent scout.
Uh-huh.
I called my high school principal, who had a brother who lived out on Long Island. His wife came in to be my talent scout. We hadn't even met, but she she was my talent scout, introduced me to Arthur. I sang and won.
What did you sing? Same song?
I Believe for Every...
Same one. You knew that like the back of your hand, right?
Yeah. And it was, you know, typical. I mean, it set the stage or the trend of my career, which was blending music with a natural faith that was very real to me. So I'm singing a song of faith, which also was a number one song for Frankie Lane.
Sure.
It had been a
Absolutely.
Huge hit. So that led then to the recording contract. The first record was a million-selling rock and roll song.
Which is amazing in those days,
yeah,
isn't it? No social networking.
No. Huh?
Nothing.
But the only networking was me going to 20 cities in 18 days. Because
hitting radio stations things like that.
Yeah. Department store record buyers, jukebox operators, and just anybody that could influence, and being on local TV dance
in
party
markets,
shows.
Yeah.
And really, the reason we did that was because after I recorded this R&B hit, which was not known to pop audiences at all, because rhythm and blues music, it was called race music, and they had their own stations and charts, but the record producers were just starting to discover some of these rhythm and blues songs that we could make into pop or what we called rock and roll. Believe it or not, there was no rock and roll until then. It was just rhythm and blues or race music and pop. So my first record was Two Hearts, Two Kisses. And when we came out of the studio at 3 in the morning in Chicago, we felt we had made perhaps a hit record. The next day, we found out that Frank Sinatra had just recorded it. Doris Day had just recorded that song. The DeCastro Sisters, some other singing group. And I'm the only unknown in the bunch. So Randy Wood of Dot Records put me on a plane and started sending me to 20 cities in 18 days.
That is exhausting.
Oh, man.
I go to two and I'm tired.
You know? And I thought, if this is the record business, I really am going to be a school teacher.
Yeah.
But
you have to do that in those days.
I did. And because of that, my record became the record of that song. And then all I had to do in May of that year, that was in March when I did it. Now, in May, I go in and record Fats Domino's Ain't That a Shame, went right to number one, and I didn't have to go anywhere.
Pat, hold on for a second. We're going to take this break. Well, is the universe valid evidence of God's universe? When we come back with Pat Boone, questions about God on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Noe. By the way, we're going to replay later on tonight Danny Buchanan's emerging artist song from Olney, Maryland. I'll tell you why. I have this very creative board op working for me tonight, and he knows that Pat Boone is in the studio, so he figured, oh, I'm going to play a Pat Boone bumper song. Well, my emerging artists are in order. I have a list. So Pat and I are listening to whom we think is Danny Buchanan commenting about how good
that,
he is.
Yeah, that guy sings good.
And it was you.
It was me. I didn't recognize my own voice. I thought it sounded familiar. But I thought, boy, that guy, he could have a record
career. So we're going to play you, Danny, later on tonight. You just keep listening. You're going to get your due. We're going to do that. Pat, you're pretty darn spiritual.
Yeah, yeah.
How did this all start for you? Were you always a spiritual?
Yes, my dad, a building contractor, mama, a registered nurse, very practical professions. But our going to church, our reading the Bible, our having family devotionals, we weren't spooky religious, but it was just a practical part of our lives. So I grew up, and my brother, my two sisters and I, to us, the existence of God, the divinity of the Bible, the whole idea of Christianity, Judeo-Christianity, that was as real to us as the sky, as breathing. So when I was in finishing grade school, wanted to go to a Christian high school. My dad, being a building contractor, I went to work, as did my brother a year later, digging ditches and pouring concrete and pushing wheelbarrows to earn the money, extra money, because Daddy's company was small.
Sure.
He couldn't afford to send us to an expensive high school. And so I earned the money. I actually worked my way through a Christian high school.
Amazing.
4 years of Latin. And then when I went to college, I studied New Testament Greek. Because the New Testament was written in a Koine or street Greek. And I wanted to be able to read it in the original because I thought I was going to be a school teacher and a located preacher, my role models. So, yeah, that was always a part of who I was and am, just as natural as breathing. And I've never had to hide it, or people have known that about me. So people have asked, is it hard to mix your faith with your career? I said, no, it was known about me from the beginning that I was a church-going guy, a believer in God, and I tried to be a good husband and a good father and a good guy, and I wanted to be a good influence on my fans, who for a long time were numbered in the millions. And so I wrote two or three books about moral behavior for kids. One was a huge bestseller while I was still in college. This is so phenomenal. I'm in college. I write a book at the request of...
Before your Pat Boone,
yeah,
right?
No. I was Pat Boone making movies. Making April Love, in fact.
Okay.
When I wrote between scenes and whatever time I could cadge away from making the movies.
God, you were young when you hit it big.
Yeah. I was 19, 20, 21 years old. So I wrote this book called Twixt 12 and 20. I didn't want to use the word teen. It was already being exploited, I thought. And they wanted to call it Pat Talks to Teens. I said, let me just call it Twixt 12 and 20. They said, that's hard to say. I said, yeah, but I like the alliteration. And if you say it two or three times, it'll stick with you, which it did. And it became the number one nonfiction bestseller for 2 years.
That's amazing.
For 2 years. And I'm still in college. So by the time I graduated at 23, I had accomplished pretty much everything I thought I wanted to accomplish in my life. And I'm just getting started.
And you're just getting started.
Yeah.
That's true. Questions about God. You know, when I look at the stars at night, Pat, or planets through telescopes, I am in wonder over the design that's out there.
Yes.
And when I interview scientists who say that they're atheists, I try to convince them that there's something out there. You know, we all have our definitions of God. Some people believe that God is human-like and he's out there somewhere.
Old fellow with a long beard.
Yeah, sitting up there in the clouds. Yeah, you know, and I tend to think that there's something there that is intelligent, that is a creator. I don't know exactly what it all is.
Well, you
but
agree.
I believe that there's something.
Well, God bless you, literally, because the Bible itself makes, I think, a number of profound scientific statements, which is why I wanted to write this book for kids, for high school and college kids, because they go to school today. They may have learned about God in Sunday school, maybe in Bible devotionals at home from their parents, hopefully. But then they go to school, and the teachers and the textbooks all pretty much deny or ignore completely the existence of a creator. And they want to teach a mindless, which I think is pretty unscientific, by the way, pretty unscientific theory called evolution. Even Darwin, in his last days, was lamenting that people were using this theory of his as a new religion, an atheistic religion,
right.
Denying. Right. And actually, people don't understand this, but atheism is a religion. It is a faith system built upon the premise that there is no God, which you cannot prove.
Right.
Versus a faith system based on the premise there certainly is a God, and the evidence is everywhere. In fact, the scientific statement I wanted to make and emphasize in this book is what the Bible says. The firmaments, not, that's a handy word, the heavens, as you just said, declare the glory of God, and the firmament, that is all created things, material things, manifest his existence. The heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament shows his handiwork. So the Bible says, you're without excuse, O man. It says, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. In his heart, not his head. Because as Aldous Huxley once said, that scientists, in his opinion, and he was a scientist, they want to deny the existence of God because to acknowledge it is to accept some responsibility mm-hmm. based on that fact.
And can't you be an evolutionist and also believe in a God?
Sure.
You should be
yes,
able to.
Because there are things that are evolving, and some species, I think, that adapt to their environments. And so there is a form of evolution, I think, going on. But there had to be a beginning. And what you said about looking up at the heavens and realizing that there has to be something somewhere agrees with a couple of great scientists we quote in this book. I say we had a co-author named Cord Cooper, who unfortunately has just passed away.
Oh, no.
So we wrote this book together, and we quote Stephen Hawking. We quote Albert Einstein. Here's, you know, Stephen Hawking, the greatest living physicist.
A great mind.
And here's a quote. The laws of science, as we know them at present, contain many fundamental numbers, like the size of the electric charge of the electron and the ratio of the masses of the proton and the electron. The values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. Now, this is this genius who wrote
Finally
A Brief
adjusted.
History of Time. Yes.
Yeah.
And he says, if one considers the possible constants and laws that could have emerged from this Big Bang, which he somewhat discounts, the odds against life like ours are immense. They are really unthinkable that from a cataclysmic, violent explosion, there could have come perfectly coordinated systems.
Order. Everything's in order.
Yeah. And it's unscientific to think that. And, of course, you ask the scientists who do believe that and who teach it, well, where did it all begin? How did it all begin? They don't know. Nobody knows. So it is a faith system built on the premise there's no God for which you cannot prove.
I have taken calls from people, Pat, when we open up the lines sometimes and talk about angelic intervention, with some of the most remarkable stories you'll ever
yeah.
hear. A truck driver one day told me he was going over the side of the road. He was falling asleep, and he was gone. He was history.
Wow.
He wakes up, sees a hand on his wheel.
Oh.
It's not his hand.
Oh.
And it pulls his truck back onto the road. He said, George, there's nobody else in the cab.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear stories like that time and time again, you have got to conclude that there's something out there
yeah.
that is divine.
We live, I believe, this in a supernatural world, and that's why people love
to hear you and your program, because there are people here who give evidence to the supernatural in this world. We live in a supernatural world. Just because we can't always see it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. You can't see electricity except maybe in a lightning
That's right.
flash. But if you stick your finger in a socket, you'll find out.
We're beaming you to millions of homes right
yeah.
now. You can't see that.
No.
But you know what? When they're on the other end of their radio,
it's
there
happening.
You are.
It's happening.
Well, let's take a few calls here, and then we'll come back and talk more about questions about God. And by the way, where do you get the book?
Amazon.com. I think it's the best place. I mean, they could go to my website, but I think Amazon.com.
Okay. Let's go to Paula in Lexington, Kentucky. Hey, Paula, you're on Coast to Coast with Pat Boone.
Hi, Pat. Hi, George.
Hi.
Can you all hear me okay?
Sure.
Okay. Pat, I about 6 years ago had invited my girlfriend and her mom over for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
They called like 10 minutes before they came to make sure I was there. I said, yeah, come on. And they came and knocked on the door, and I didn't answer. They looked into my living room through the front window. I was passed out on the floor, and my cat, Mickey, was sitting on top of my chest.
Really?
They called an ambulance. They took me to the hospital here in Lexington. I had a brain infection, heart attack, and a stroke all in 1 week. I survived that. I'm a BAM, an ex-Marine, and the VA wrote me a letter last week saying that because I have Medicaid and Medicare, they won't take care of me anymore.
Oh.
And now, about a month ago, I had an onset of severe arthritis in my hands.
Mm-hmm.
I have a daughter and four grandsons. I wanted to write a book for them about my life
mm-hmm.
because of the brain infection. The doctors have told me I will probably be getting Alzheimer's because mm-hmm. of the brain infection. Before I had Andrea, I took care of people with Alzheimer's, so I know,
mm-hmm.
you know, what's coming.
Well, don't accept that.
I believe that God will heal me. He has healed me once before.
Yeah.
When I was in the Marine Corps, my mom committed suicide, and I got out. They discharged me because I had a duodenal ulcer so large it was blocking food from
me. Boy, you've had a lot of problems.
She's had everything happen to her. But you've got to be a believer in order to fight that, don't
you? Know,
you?
Yes. I just read something the prophet Isaiah said to the people of Israel. I think he says it to all of us. Except your faith remain firm, I cannot make you stand firm. That's something to really think about. Except your faith remain firm, I cannot make you stand firm. If you don't maintain your faith contact with the source, with the one who can change things, who can heal you, who can raise the dead, if you don't believe, then you limit what he can or will do for you. But if you believe, anything is possible.
I'm a believer, Pat, in God. I'm a believer in life after death. I'm a believer that our spirit, our soul moves on.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years ago, a friend of mine died in a motorcycle accident. So I went to the funeral in St. Louis.
Yeah.
And I'm looking in the casket, and I hate that, by the way. I hate going to funerals. You know, when I go, close the thing.
Me too.
I don't want anybody staring at me. Just be done with it. But I'm looking at him, and it hits me for the first time. That what if there's nothing?
Yeah.
What if this is it? He's dead, void, darkness, it's over. And I've got to tell you, I snapped out of it. But for that split second, it was one of the worst feelings I've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that feeling of loneliness and darkness.
And
it's horrible.
And despair.
Yeah.
You know, I think I said at your luncheon yesterday that the psychologists and psychiatrists commit suicide more often than any other profession.
Yeah.
Because they work with people with emotional problems, with psychological problems, and many of our physical problems are based in psychological fears, anxieties, guilts. And I quoted, you know, that joke that has been around for years about the psychoanalyst talking to the very mousy, anxious-looking lady saying, "Ma'am, let me tell you the truth. You don't have an inferiority complex. You are inferior." And you can say the same thing about, you don't have a guilt complex. You are guilty. Yeah. We walk around, most of us, with a feeling of guilt or shame, buried perhaps, not on the surface, knowing that we've done things that fell short of what we expected of ourselves. We did things we wouldn't want other people to know. We carry guilt about things. Sometimes children carry guilt because of their parents' divorces.
Right. They blame themselves.
And they think it was their fault.
And they carry that.
And it warps them.
Yes, you're right.
Well, if you can get free of guilt and fear and anxiety, and that's what a faith in a creator God who can do anything can do for you, then it's a wonderful way to live. But if you don't believe, like Chris Hitchens right now, I really hurt for him because he's taken such a stand against the existence of God. He's been very militant. He's written a couple of best-selling books. And now that he is living under a death sentence and dying, he says, look, I appreciate the fact that people call me or write me and say they're praying for me. Mm-hmm. And that's nice. But however, it's not going to ever change my steadfast conviction that there is no God. Well, so he's looking into an abyss. He's looking into nothingness. Maybe if he's hurting enough physically, some people, that's why some of the psychiatrists, psychoanalysts kill themselves. It's a painful way to live without any sense that you're going to, that there's something beyond. If you endure some pain or even you endure death, that it's actually a birth into another existence or a continuation on a different scale, which I believe it is. I don't think we do die in the sense that we go out of existence. I think we just pass from this body almost like that locust or that cicada that just comes out and leaves its shell on the side of a tree.
Yeah.
And it goes.
There it is.
Yeah.
And it goes on.
But I do believe we do go on, and that there is a hereafter, and there's great solace in that, and it takes away a lot of the pain. Our military on the battlefield, when they've been terribly injured and they think they may be dying, and they say, tell my wife and my kids I love them, and it's very tragic. But for the family and for that person, as he is expiring, to be able to believe, and it seems to be intrinsic in us, that we will see each other again, that there's the likelihood that we are not separated forever, that we don't cease to exist. Animals don't have that assurance.
No.
So they race right into a deadly situation maybe, and the idea they may cease to exist, it doesn't matter. But we appreciate life because we know that, or we believe that there's something after this. We want to make the most of this life.
And you don't want to cut it short.
Right. No, nobody's in a hurry to get out.
Yeah.
It is, I don't know how people face tragedy, really, without a sense of God and his comfort and his solace. My mom and dad both died within 6 weeks of each other. We had wonderful ceremonies that we called them going home celebrations. And the funeral director who was officiating over everything, putting it all together, was very choked up afterwards. And he said, you know, I've been doing this 30 years of putting that funeral, people's funeral services together. And I've never seen two services in which everybody talked about the deceased's future more than their past.
That's great. Pat, I want to thank you for being on. Questions about God, Pat Boone. You're a wonder, my friend.